Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Andrew Rostenberg. Today we're going to discuss MTHFR. Andrew's working on a book called Beyond MTHFR, and as many of my patients here in Atlanta with chemical toxicity from, well, just general chemical toxicity, or specifically from the chemicals coming out of silicone implants that are leaking, get very ill from this, I decided to ask Andrew to come on the radio show today to give us more insight into this. There's actually more than just one defect. MTHFR is a methylation defect, but there's other defects in the detoxification pathways. And this is rather new science. It's not been around for that long. And the doctors are trying to figure this out. I do want to tell the listening audience that we did interview the father of homocysteine, and that interview is available at www.plasticos.com. And in that interview, you'll see that people who have these methylation defects often later on get high homocysteine levels. So if you've got a heavy metal load, if you've got a lot of the things we're going to talk about today, gut issues, adrenal issues, and find yourself with a homocysteine that's creeping up, chances are you may have one of these detoxification defects. And it's actually very important to get this treated, because if you don't, you have an increased risk of heart attack, stroke, and cancer. And these are the things we're going to talk about today. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Dr. Kolb, thank you so much for having me on your show.
So, as I said in the introduction, I came across these because I was seeing a lot of patients with chemical toxicity from all sorts of things, but including the hydrophobic chemicals that are coming out of breast implants when they leak. How did you get interested in this topic?
That's a great question, Dr. Kolb. So, you know, for your audience, just to give them a little background, you know, my training is chiropractic. That's what drew me to, you know, becoming a doctor to help people. I like working with my hands. I believe in, you know, the physical body and how important the structure and the architecture of who we are in a physical sense is. And I was actually in college studying electrical engineering and architecture before I decided to change course and go for chiropractic. So I have this background of looking at structure and understanding that structure and function are very much related. So when I was in chiropractic college, we would do x-rays and learn about, you know, what they call quote-unquote the normal variance. And it always struck me as kind of odd. Is it normal or is it a variance? Why do we call it a normal variant, right? And so what I'm speaking to are things like spina bifida and posterior pontocles. Not everybody in the audience may know what those are. Those are like changes up at the base of the skull. People may be born, for example, with an extra lumbar vertebrae or a hemivertebrae, a vertebrae that wasn't quite formed correctly, you know, leading to scoliosis or some other, you know, kind of common complaint that we see in practice. And so that stuck with me, and I thought, okay, so, you know, spina bifida, you know, if it's severe enough, it'll actually kill the baby. And my understanding is that still the number one cause of loss of pregnancy is a birth defect caused by a neural tube problem. And so I started to look into this from that point of view, from a structural point of view, and that kind of led me down this, you know, rabbit hole of investigation. And, you know, the more you learn about something, the more you begin to recognize it, connecting to all these other aspects. And so from my point of view, what drew me to it was first the physical presentation of this problem, where you could look at somebody and, you know, look and see that they have an epicanthal fold. They have if you look at the face, for example, of individuals, you'll see an additional piece of tissue near the eye. And I'm sure as being a, you know, doctor yourself, you're aware of this, the epicanthal fold. And so, you know, that's actually related to MTHFR. So one of the screening tools I use in my office is I just grab my thumb and I touch the cheek and I pull down and away from the eye. And in individuals with really pronounced expression of MTHFR, you'll see this epicanthal fold show up, and it can often be so bad you can see it with your naked eye. So just kind of looking at it from that point of view, I thought, okay, if I can see this stuff on the outside without even doing testing and no invasive procedures, no radiation, no needles, we can start to figure out who has genetic problems just by looking at them. And that was really what caught my imagination.
Well, it's interesting because the neural tube defects caused the government to put folic acid in a lot of different foods, thinking that that would help. But there's a problem with folic acid, which is more the unnatural form of folate, which is the natural form, in patients with MTHFR. In other words, it doesn't really help them as much because of the methylation defect. We really need methylfolate to be the active form of folate. And what's so interesting about my patient population is that nobody, and I've tested probably over 500 people, nobody tests for methylfolate every day. You actually have to give it to them twice a week or once a week if they don't weigh very much. And if you give it to them every day, they get massive symptoms of viruses. I think the viruses feed off the folate. So, you know, these methyl B12 and folate supplements, we're telling them to take twice a week. And then the B12, if you have silicone toxicity, this is probably something you've not heard of, but if you have massive amounts of silicone, either from leakage or rupture, high doses of B12 are needed to protect the neurological system because they're neurotoxins. And so if you've got MTHFR, we recommend high doses of methyl B12 rather than regular B12 because the regular B12 is not protective. But if you don't have the methylation defect, you can use regular B12. It gets converted just fine. And then every patient that gets high doses of B12, and we're talking like 2,000 micrograms every 1 to 2 weeks, says that it helps them. So that's something that we just found by trial and error. I think I just started putting people on B12 just to do it. I'm not even sure why I did it, but if you give them the right form of B12, it's very neuroprotective.
I think those are great points, and you know that was part of my research into the neural tube defects. You're exactly right. They did add folic acid, and based on the science they had at the time, and based on it being a government intervention, mm-hmm. that actually did reduce death. There are people walking around alive today because we fortified our food. But now the plot thickens, and there's some nuances now about, you know, how we convert folic acid into folate. And, you know, I would also like to just share with your audience, too, it's not just neural tube defects from the point of view like a spina bifida issue. It's also really what we look at with methylation, and when people are growing in utero, when we're in the womb, any methylation problem can cause a defect in the symmetry of our body. So mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier, like hemivertebrae. So you basically mm-hmm. have 26 vertebrae as an adult, but then you're born with like half of one, and so it creates a, you know, it's not a flat surface, so it changes your spine from being horizontal mm-hmm. with the ground to now it's got a 45-degree angle, and your body has to, you know, create a scoliosis or something to try to keep your head level with the horizon. But they did studies with mice, and they basically created a pregnant mouse model and depleted the mom of folate. And when she gave birth, the mice were born with hemivertebra in their tail.
Mm-hmm.
So it's... The methylation, I think, is so fascinating because it's such a deep system. It's so fundamental and rudimentary to our chemistry that if you get it right, you get an enormous laundry list of benefits. Conversely, when it's not working well, you get an enormous laundry list of problems.
So tell the listening audience a little bit more about what a methylation defect is, because a lot of them are probably clueless as to what that means.
Yeah, I think most doctors are still trying to figure it out. And I'm not, you know, it's, you know, I always tell people, and I mean this sincerely, that if you're willing to be confused, you will learn a lot. The mm-hmm. point of knowledge is not to wake up every day and go, you know, I'm done learning. I've gotten every piece of knowledge and information on planet Earth, and I can stop trying. That doesn't work. So we're always looking for new information and new meaning for this information that we already have. But we've got to understand what methylation is. All methylation is, in its most basic, rudimentary sense, is moving carbon from one place to another. Think of Atlanta. It's a major city. There's banks all over Atlanta. People are saving dollars in their savings account. They're getting paid in dollars on payday. They're spending dollars at the grocery store, at the restaurant, at the movie theater. And it's that flow of dollars that keeps Atlanta moving. If we wake up on Monday and everybody's bank account is zero and there's no dollars around, you know, we could negotiate something else to trade for that food at the store, but it's not really going to work very well. The body and the economy need their currency. So I look at methylation like it's the currency that the body uses to make biochemical changes to help us grow, to help us repair. So methylation defects are basically, for the audience, and the most famous one is MTHFR, and there's all these other, you know, related pathways that are important. That's what, you know, the work I'm focused on is looking at. But there's people born with enzymes of different speeds, and your enzymes are just tiny microscopic little machines. They're buzzing they're moving parts. They're mobile little machines made out of protein. And depending on your DNA, you either make the perfect one that's super fast, you make the one that's kind of slow, or you make the one that's just really sluggish. Mm-hmm. And that's where your problems come from, because if your MTHFR system is not rapid in its ability to convert folates from your diet, and folate comes in different forms. It's not always, when you eat a salad, it doesn't always come in the form of methylfolate. Sometimes it comes into, folate. There's maybe a dozen or so folates that are very similar in chemistry, and they all have to get converted into methylfolate, folic acid being one of them. So this is what people experience. They have a slow conversion into methylfolate, and so what that basically means is when their body's stressed, here's what I tell my patients. This may help. I think this will help frame it a little bit. I always start discussions concerning genetics by pointing out that our genes are not our destiny, but they are our tendency. Mm-hmm. And that tendency doesn't show up unless our body's stressed. So unless someone like your patient population goes through a surgery to introduce foreign material into the body, and the foreign material is, you know, as much as we'd like to think chemically inert, it's just not true. And so as these molecules of, you know, whatever chemicals were used to produce the breast implant slowly leach out, every molecule, every petrochemical, every organic, you know, chemical molecule that's coming out of the breast tissue is going to be a molecule that your body has to waste magnesium and zinc and methyl groups to get rid of. And that's magnesium, zinc, and methyl groups that they pee out and they'll never get back.
Right. And every patient has zinc deficiencies, magnesium deficiencies. We use magnesium malic acid as the best choice for putting that back, because it helps the Krebs cycle. And then the methyl problems. I haven't done my MTHFR panel, but I want to describe something to you, and maybe you've seen this before. I muscle test best for regular B12, probably because it's cheaper. I don't need methyl B12. I can use methyl B12, but I don't need it. But I do need to take regular B12, 2,000 micrograms every 2 weeks, or 3 weeks, actually 3 weeks now. And I had 30 grams of silicone gel disappear in my body, so, you know, I had a huge toxic load at one point. I do, however, I do have to take methylfolate twice a week. So what would you say, do you have an idea of what my problem is? And I also muscle test for MSM twice a day. So I must need methyl groups. But B12 isn't one of the problems, so it must be something with the folate. Do you see?
So this is a good question. We can look at it a couple different ways. So we have we have about 30,000 genes based on the Human Genome Project. That's basically what they figured out. You know, it used to be 22,000, now they're saying 30,000. So out of those 30,000, you know, we're looking at maybe a couple hundred and really getting those dialed for what we work on with methylation. Not to say the other ones don't matter, but you have genes that control how B12 moves into your cells. So what we see with patients is we see patients who don't supplement with B12 that they'll do a blood test and their B12 is high or off the chart, out of range, elevated. And so what basically is, it's almost like some people think about it from a biological point of view. You know, the body is a genius. And I love telling patients this because I know that it's true. The body never makes mistakes. There is not a single body on this planet that's ever made a mistake. It does the best that it can do with what it has every second we're alive. If only we could aspire to be that effective with our time on Earth, with our, like, personal consciousness, you know? But the body's perfect. So if you don't need B12, my thinking is that there were groups of people who lived in an environment where B12 was scarce, and so they were selected for, over time, the people who have a poor B12 receptor on the cell. And so basically what it does is it boosts your blood level of B12 really high and keeps it there for a long time.
To tell you one other thing. My mother had pernicious anemia. So throw that into the mix.
Yeah,
I don't know whether I do or not. I mean, I'm not sure because I've never allowed myself to become B12 deficient, you know.
Did she have the autoimmune disease, or was she simply B12 deficient with...
She developed peripheral neuropathy and hearing loss and eventually stomach cancer, probably from the traditional pernicious anemia. For years, I had her on oral methyl B12 sublingual because she didn't want to do the shots. So she developed these problems before I figured out the B12 problem. And then when I managed it, she did better, but she still died of stomach cancer, which, of course, is a complication of pernicious anemia. So
yeah, I mean, I think that,
you know,
you're onto a good point there as well. And we use probably more bottles of hydrochloric betaine stomach acid with our patients than perhaps any other supplement that I've ever used. And, you know, there's so many people who are hypoglycemic. And as we age, we produce less stomach acid. If we're hypoglycemic, anytime our body releases glucagon, it actually, one of the physiological effects of glucagon is to suppress stomach acid production. So, you know, I think that's relating back to, you know, if you have a mother in your family, a person in your family with pernicious anemia, looking at, you know, stomach acid function is a, it's just one of those first-line approaches we do with everyone, because if you get the stomach functioning correctly, you get more of the methyl groups from food, and food becomes more medicine instead of having to rely on such high doses of supplements.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, that's a big part of what we look at is gut function, because, you know, not because there aren't other things that are important, but it's like I've learned through working with, you know, thousands of patients we've taken care of that if you just look at someone's genetic report and jump after genes without, you have to treat the person. You have to, if they've been on 50 rounds of antibiotics and they're 38 years old, you know, they're not going to respond well to taking supplements orally that have a lot of B vitamins in them until their gut is working a lot better.
And silicone toxicity makes it so you don't absorb B12 from the gut, probably because of dysbiosis, like you said, with antibiotics. And so injectable B12 is you know, what muscle tests better than even sublingual.
Have you ever used transdermal with your patients?
No, I haven't. I just usually give them high doses of shots, but transdermal might be a good way to do it if they don't want to do the shot.
Sure. We've had good results with it. One company that makes a good one is called New Medica, and they have a neuromethyl. Yep, neuromethylation cream. That stuff works pretty well.
Okay, great.
Yeah, so just maybe touching back on the B12 and the folate, I mean, you know, just for your listeners to understand, you know, we get patients who walk in, they say, look, I've got MTHFR. It's the explanation for all these problems. And I say, well, that's, you know, again, that's partly true. It's your weakness. You know, metal, when it's under stress, there's a point on a metal beam or a metal bar that if it's bent, it's going to, or if it's stressed, it will bend, and if you stress it again, it's going to keep bending in that spot. That's a lot like our genetic weakness. So we kind of can determine where people are going to have problems based on their genetic profile. But we really have to treat the person. And I think if you're, you know, your population sounds like you're dealing with chemical toxicity. You've got a phenotype in your office of women and maybe men as well who have been exposed to, you know, just an enormous amount of chemical toxicity because of what's going on in their tissues. And so, you know, the thing is methylation problems, at the end of the day, they simply slow down the body's ability to rally and to adapt to the changing circumstances of which is going on chemically. So normally we get exposed to a toxin, some kind of petrochemical, some pesticide, and it actually will upregulate your phase one system. It'll induce that very quickly, and then you'll have a phase two where, you know, if I use a description that phase one is like putting logs into your fireplace and lighting them on fire. That's what phase one is like. Phase two is making sure the smoke goes out the chimney and the fire doesn't burn down your house. A lot of people are good at lighting fires. They're not
right.
So good at
keeping
it low.
Well, let me tell you what happens with silicone toxicity in people that have glutathione defects. They get massive free radicals and they start to age. I mean, I had one patient I actually operated on yesterday whose arms started to age at a rapid rate, so much so that she got needling in order to tighten the skin back up. I mean, she's really started to age incredibly quickly. So you're seeing in my patient population exactly what you just described. The free radicals that accumulate when the second phase of detoxification is slow end up aging the person. And I think the free radicals also are responsible for the vascular and the potential cancer problems, you know, just because it's damaging tissue.
No question. I mean, that's, you know, I have patients who they're homozygous, so they have inherited both versions of MTHFR, C677T, which is the, you know, most well understood and the worst potential inherited version of that. It's like the weakest enzyme you can get. And she was on birth control, and she's 32, and 30 days later she has a stroke and loses, you know, she has a giant stroke in her right hemisphere because of the clotting that came from all that estrogen. So they give, you know, so you're, it's people who are sensitive, people who get sick when others don't, that's a methylation problem until proven otherwise. Babies who are born with any cleft palate, any midline defect, any leg length discrepancy, scoliosis, Marfan syndrome, any of those, you know, deviations from symmetry. So you have the physical model to look at and say, okay, you know, remember the kid at the swimming pool with a big dent in their chest and real long, tall, lanky kid? You know, that's the Marfan phenotype, and that's related back to methylation cycle problems and homocysteine, and there's a lot of cardiovascular disease in the Marfan's population.
Right.
So you're absolutely right. If we could get, Dr. Kolb, if we could get this information that you're working on and I'm working on out into, you know, the greater awareness, I mean, you'd see cancer, heart disease, and stroke go way down.
And breast implant problems, you know? If people would just make sure they don't have a detoxification defect before they get breast implants. I mean, a lot of these women, they can get saline breast implants as long as they don't have mold in their environment. I was on Monsters Inside Me twice with mold inside saline breast implants, so that's not a great idea either if you live in Louisiana or, you know, Florida and have mold in your house. But basically what we found is that with women with any of the detoxification defects, they really do poorly with silicone gel implants because they all leak. They all leak eventually, I will say that. Some of them don't leak so much at first. It seems to be the brand that leaks. You know, there's a certain brand that leaks more than the other one, and then the other one doesn't leak as much. And, you know, I can't say that on the air because of problems with the company. But basically, you know, we have to warn women before they get breast implants that they're setting themselves up for chemical toxicity if they've got one of these detoxification defects. And then look at heavy metal toxicity. I mean, people with MTHFR that have heavy metals, like mercury fillings and lead from, because they were children when there was leaded gasoline, they all have high heavy metal problems.
It's really more common than we first might think. And, you know, before I became a doctor and looked into this, you know, you just didn't think about heavy metals. But now that you know where to look, you see them everywhere. The interesting thing, you know, just so your callers can understand, I mean, I think that with methylation, or your audience, excuse me, methylation is so, it's such a, like, big, nerdy subject, and it's like we're speaking English, but it doesn't sound like it. It's like we're speaking a code with all these different abbreviations. And, you know, I've spent literally thousands of hours looking at the chart and building and drawing and looking at the chart of the methylation cycle. So when I'm thinking about it, I have this visual picture of how these things fit together. But to the audience, you know, I want you to think that you basically, it's like a big intersection inside of your cells. It's like a giant roundabout. And in this roundabout, you know, the methyl groups are keeping traffic flowing. You've got delivery trucks coming in, bringing in protein to your cells, and then they're being directed down a street where they're going to turn that protein into glutathione, into an antioxidant, into a sulfur group. Like you mentioned, MSM, you know, sulfur deficiency, super common in chronic disease and detoxification issues. And then you have that, inside that roundabout, you have, you know, deliveries being made with these carbon groups that get directed over towards the DNA. And so just to talk real quick on, you know, why I want to speak to the heavy metal component and make sure we have a chance to talk a little bit about methylation and cancer. I think that's what every woman needs
important,
to know.
Yeah.
And also, you know, when you were talking about your clientele with these, you know, leaking breast implants, I was just thinking about, you know, what if they become pregnant, right? What if they get breast implants when they're 21 and now they're having children and they're 27 and they're 30? What is that toxicity? What are the downstream epigenetic effects?
They have a lot of miscarriages. And let me tell you something. So many of my patients get pregnant right after, like within a couple of months after getting explanted, because they're used to being infertile, and so they don't take as much precaution, right? But then when you remove those chemicals, guess what? They get pregnant easily.
Well, that's what we want. We want the wonderful, you know, loving mothers and fathers of this world who are seeking to, you know, propagate our species to have the opportunity. It's really, I see a lot more infertility in my office, you know, than I first thought was, you know, you just don't realize how many people are infertile, but infertility responds extremely well, as you've said, to getting the toxins out of your body, but definitely also to supporting methylation. I mean, it's, so, you know, you mentioned heavy metals, and we, you know, I'm a big research geek, and, you know, what I'm looking at with heavy metals is metalloestrogens. And so the things that we call heavy metals, like lead and mercury and arsenic and cadmium, the body considers to be estrogen. And I know that sounds kind of extreme, but the research is pretty clear that when you have lead in your body, when you have mercury, it doesn't just cause, you know, damage to the DNA and create inflammation. What it also does is it will actually go into the nucleus of the cell, and it will bind where estrogen is supposed to bind.
Right.
So you've got not only, it just kind of ties back into this estrogen dominance problem that we see a lot of, and you mentioned malic acid earlier. Malic acid's really good for the Krebs cycle, and it also helps with gallbladder problems.
It softens gallstones.
Softens gallstones. And why do gallstones happen? Well, you know, normally bile is soap-like. It's like your dish soap. You go home, you grab your dish soap, you squeeze the bottle really hard, you could probably squirt it across the room. It's really runny. That's what your bile is supposed to be like. But because of methylation issues and the toxin exposure and, you know, from, like, you know, before conception, through conception, babies, adults, you know, we're just inundated with this garbage, then the gallbladder begins to malfunction. And I actually, in my practice, when I'm doing a physical exam and I talk to patients and I'm doing, you know, palpating their body and finding pain, the pain over the gallbladder is the number one most reliable marker of methylation problems.
Yeah.
And so, you know, just for your callers to see the connection, you know, your listeners, that there's heavy metals in our body, and they're very much actively stimulating our tissues. And from a female mm-hmm. point of view, they've discovered that if you know, mercury and lead and these heavy metals are capable of causing the lining of the uterus to proliferate.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you've got multiple chemicals in the environment that are estrogen, that mimic estrogen, like the pesticides and the BPA and the plastics,
right.
And now we have metals. So it's like we really are being poisoned by estrogen, whether you're a man, woman, or child, and that estrogen causes the gallbladder and the bile to get very thick. That's why women have more gallstones than men. There's an estrogen component there.
Yeah, and I want to tell the listening audience that if you read about these gallbladder cleanses, be very careful about doing it without proper supervision, because if you have hard gallstones and try one of these cleanses, you can get an emergency surgical situation. And I find a lot better for in my patient population using malic acid to soften the gallstones and then phosphoric acid to dissolve the gallstones, rather than try to do one of these cleanses straight off and not knowing how big the gallstones are, how hard they are. You don't want them to get stuck in the common bile duct, or you can get a surgical emergency.
That's absolutely correct. So, you know, definitely to your listeners, I mean, if you have any question about your gallbladder health, you go and do an ultrasound. It's pretty easy. Non-invasive study, and just get an idea. I mean, I've had patients with stones that were 4 centimeters, and then the next time, you know, 3 months later, they're 2 centimeters.
Or there's sand. So. If it's sand, you can go ahead and do it. You know, if it's,
right. If it's sludge.
You know, if they're tiny, or if they're just sand, just thick bile, that's okay. But you don't want to get one of these things stuck in your common bile duct. Or else
absolutely.
You could die. I mean, literally, I used to be a general surgeon. I mean, people do still die of common bile duct problems.
Yeah, not to be messed with. And I think a lot of patients, you know, and I respect this, that they're so frustrated with the medical system that they're just, you know, they're getting so little help at their doctor's office that they're willing to get on any forum and read anything. But, you know, there are professionals out here who are on your level and who will make your journey a lot more comfortable and a lot more effective. You know?
Right. So that's, you know, and actually for most treatments, things are so complicated, you know, that there's so many different things to consider that I know you do applied kinesiology, and I do it on all my patients. I really think that applied kinesiology can keep patients and doctors out of trouble, because there's so many things we probably don't even understand yet. And sometimes when I think that, you know, a certain supplement or drug is going to be the answer, but when I muscle test for it, they're weak as a kitten, you know, don't give it, because it's not going to work the way you think it is.
I'm really glad you said that, Dr. Call, because, you know, the idea that the body's a genius, it's not, you know, I'm not being facetious or anything
right.
like that. It's absolutely true. There is... Every cell is like its own Einstein, and we're just a little pea brain version of that system. I mean, there's no way we
mm-hmm.
could, with the greatest intellectual, quote-unquote, intellectual minds in the world, we couldn't build anything close to what the body does.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a way to talk to the body, to ask it questions and have a dialogue with it, you know,
mm-hmm.
the body won't email, it won't write a sticky note, it won't text us, but it will answer in its own language, which is binary code, yes or no, off and on, ones and zeros.
Right.
How cool is that? I mean, that is the best
that
thing
is.
Ever.
Yeah. Well, if they would just use that in medicine, we wouldn't have a healthcare crisis anymore, a financial crisis. We just wouldn't have it. Of course, probably a lot of the pharmaceutical industry would go out of business, of course, but that would be okay.
Oh, yes. There's no money in solving problems. There's only money in treating them. Come on. You know that, right?
That's true. But, you know, most of my patients anyway, don't muscle test for half the drugs they're on. You know, the knee-jerk reaction of the medical community is to put somebody with chronic disease on SSRI inhibitors and you know, Klonopin and other GABA drugs. But, you know, in reality, it's much better to treat the actual problem. We use Gabitrol and other GABA, it's not just GABA, though. You have to do the cofactors. They all have anxiety because they have a GABA deficiency. They have other neurotransmitter deficiencies that are pretty common when they have silicone toxicity. And then, so replacing the actual thing rather than just taking a shotgun approach with these prescriptions. I mean, like Lyrica doesn't work at all in any of my fibromyalgia patients because their fibromyalgia is not going to respond to Lyrica. And I haven't found a single patient yet who says that Lyrica works. So obviously the chemical toxicity, you know, the yeast overgrowth, mold overgrowth, that kind of toxicity doesn't respond to Lyrica. There might be another one that does. I don't know. They got FDA approval for Lyrica and fibromyalgia, so obviously somebody responds to it. It might be a placebo effect, though. My patient population isn't responding to it.
I agree. I think we need, I mean, no offense to anybody who's anybody, but, you know, if we need more doctors who can prescribe drugs, like we need a hole in our head. I mean, we have no shortage
right.
of drugs. Why don't we figure out how to fix the body without
naturally.
Poisoning it?
Yeah.
You know, and thank God for, you know, an antibiotic when there's like a sepsis and someone's dying on the emergency room.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's great. You know, but so I spend most of my days spent understanding what people have been, they've been through something stressful. You know, the patients that come in, they're not, most of my patients are, you know, dealing with some chronic disease, some kind of, mm-hmm. myoclonic epilepsy in a teenager. Or, you know, somebody's, you know, lost the ability to walk and move their left leg because of, you know, all these things we're talking about, methylation imbalances, gut problems, weakening their core, shutting off their major muscle stable, you know, their quadratus lumborum, their rectus abdominals. And since you muscle test, you know all this stuff. And so then their discs become, you know, their instability physically is a reflection of their instability chemically, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So you have that relationship. So I just believe, I really have this fundamental deep-seated belief. I go to work every day with this idea in my head that, you know, people get better and that we're not, that there is a solution to these problems out there. And
well, there is. If we understood the functional medicine component, you know, functional medicine wasn't around when I was in medical school. I was in medical school in the late 70s. But we did have function and structure education. You know, back in the first year of medical school, we studied physiology, and the idea was drilled into our head that, you know, structure and function are related. And I took industrial psychology, so I understood how systems work, you know, engineering systems worked in terms of, like, causing airplane accidents. You know, so it's similar. If things are screwed up in terms of the way things are built or you know, functions occur, then you can pretty predictably get the problem, whether it be cancer, heart disease, whatever it is. But then you have to look back and see what happened to bring you to that point. And that's why I think it's so interesting you had an engineering background, because it is all in functional medicine is really an engineering problem. I mean, it really is. It's like what got screwed up at this point that led to this problem, that led to that problem, and then finally led to increased risk of cancer.
You have to analyze. You said something very poignant there. You have to analyze systems, and it takes
right.
It, but what systems analysis does for a doctor is it makes the doctor more confused, and it makes the doctor take more time, and it makes the doctor have to do more research and do more work and be a lot more mm-hmm. flexible in how they approach problems.
Right.
That's
that
the
doesn't
system
fit
we
in
have
with is, a five minute office visit.
Yeah, that is not going to happen. You know, so they're going to replace 5 minute office visits with robot visits. Right, that's the dream of the future.
Yeah,
you just have you have a modified ATM machine that poops out medication for you. You just all you got to
right.
do is scan in your blood work, and they'll take care of you. Right.
Yeah.
It's so you know there's a huge opportunity, and I'm kind of being obviously facetious at this point, but you know, and I'm not trying to be negative because I kind of have a phrase that I like to say that You know, if you like solving problems, then there's never been a better time to be alive. So if
right.
you're bored,
yeah.
if you're sitting around wondering what to do with your life, I mean, pick, let's get, there's plenty to work on, you know?
Mm-hmm. There is. So when you've got patients with heavy metal toxicity, say they come in with, you know, and they've got a hair analysis or urine analysis that shows that they're just really suffering with heavy metals, what do you do then? How do you work them up?
That's a good question. So, you know, looking at what kind of tests they have is one of the first things I want to make sure I understand. So if it's a hair test, you know, that's current exposure. So, hey, do you eat fish 5 times a week, 3 times a week? You've been eating fish 3 times a week with mercury off the charts in your hair, you know, mm-hmm. For the last
tuna
10
fish.
Years, you know.
Tuna fish is a big one.
Tuna fish, man. Yeah, because so your audience needs to understand, guys, the bigger the fish, the more mercury. So sardines
right.
are a much better choice than tuna. Tuna's huge. It's like as big
right.
as a, you know, minivan. So I look at that, and then I look, you know, if it's like a provocative urine test, you know, I'm a little with metals. Here's my opinion of metals. I'm not doing IV chelation and real aggressive, you know, stuff with patients. You know, my
mm-hmm.
understanding of how the body gets rid of heavy metals is from this fundamental physiologic point of view. We get rid of metals in the bile. That's where most of our heavy metals come out of our body. The problem
right.
is, we've already talked about how messed up our gallbladder function is because of our methylation cycle being disturbed and being estrogen toxic and making it all
mm-hmm.
sludgy. But not only that, you know, when we release, so, you know, one thing I want these patients with heavy metals to do is I want to make sure that they release bile when they eat. So I'm looking at gut, making sure that the stomach is acidic so that cholecystokinin gets released from the duodenum, triggers
mm-hmm.
bile release. You know, I'm helping to thin the bile, helping to get the lipotrophic nutrients in there. But that's
mm-hmm.
only really the first step, because once bile's released, about 95% of the mercury that's in the bile is sucked back in through the hepatic, enterohepatic circulation. So I use
mm-hmm.
binding agents in the gut. I like, I use a type of charcoal called Takasumi. And
uh-huh.
have you heard of that before?
No, huh?
It's basically a kinesiologist. You want to look this guy up. He's a really sharp guy. His name is Dr. Michael Leibowitz, and he does
mm-hmm.
kinesiology seminars. I think you would be a perfect fit for one of his Saturday seminars. He has a great protocol for testing, but he's also developed some really good supplements based off his muscle testing. So he found
mm-hmm.
in Japan they have bamboo charcoal. It's like the purest, awesome, most best charcoal that we can get our hands on. So I'll do a charcoal, you know, 2 times a day as they eat, or excuse me,
mm-hmm.
between meals, to bind that mercury that gets released when they eat. And so that starts to reduce heavy metal burden. We also like to upregulate the protein in the body called metallothionein.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, and again, not getting too complicated here with the audience, but, you know, metallothionein lives in the wall of your gut. It lives in your brain. It lives in other parts of your body. And what it does is it basically acts like a chaperone. It grabs on to mercury and heavy metals in it. It squirts it out of your cell and out of your body.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can increase that expression, we increase excretion of heavy metals. They found that, you know, one supplement we use for Metagenics increases the urinary removal excretion of mercury about 900%. And it's just by increasing metallothionein. So it's to me, that's a safe, gentle way to get heavy metals out. I've heard the horror stories of people doing, you know, aggressive chelation and things. And I'm not suggesting that it doesn't work for everyone, but it kind of like what your comment was on the gallbladder, you have to be nuanced with this. Not everybody's going to be a great candidate to sit in a chair and have a have an IV.
Yeah,
chelate,
you know, I recommend, you know. We used to do IV chelation here before the insurance for it got taken away. And the best people for IV chelation are people with, you know, impending or after heart attacks, strokes, and dead legs. Those are emergency situations, and chelation works better than anything. But, you know, the same guy that developed IV chelation developed oral chelation, Dr. Gordon, and we recommend oral chelation. But what's the name of the Metagenic supplement that you just recommended, though, for the mercury?
That one's called Metalloclear, and they've done a lot of cell studies on hops like the kinase. And so they have this, there's a portion of the hops plant that is like really, really good at upregulating the expression of metallothionein. And metallothionein is really good. So I use this type of a product with anybody with an estrogen problem, because remember, the heavy metals drive estrogen signaling. Get great results with that. And it's also really good with anybody with a lot of brain inflammation, microglial activation, NMDA receptor problems, you know, those, a lot of those people who might have been prescribed Lyrica for pain, they have that excess glutamate. They're not converting it into GABA. They're getting all that pain firing and, you know, sympathetic system activation. This really is a good tool for that.
Well, that's a great idea, though, to, you know, to have the body tuned up to the point where they can release more, the body can release more of the mercury and heavy metals rather than, I mean, of course, you've got to go on the other route and decrease the amount being taken in, you know, with the fish and the you know, getting the mercury fillings out, especially if they're cracked. But certainly this is a really good way, and I'm going to incorporate this into my muscle testing to see if we can get heavy metals out, you know, in other ways than just EDTA.
I think that the body's a genius, and I think it's going to, you know, we just give the body what it needs in the right amount and prevent the body from getting exposed to what injures it, and I think we just kind of step out of the way and let it do its thing, you know.
And charcoal is a good thing that I've underutilized charcoal. You do have to be careful with charcoal about medication. You know, it'll bind onto medication. You don't want to take your thyroid at the same time you take your charcoal, because it'll bind onto it and pull it out of the body rather than get it absorbed. That's one caveat with that.
Great points.
So, and it'll also bind other supplements, so you have to be careful with that too.
Yeah, and I want to mention one more thing, you know, in the time we have left, just for your audience to keep in mind. You know, I have patients who are very, you know, ill and sick and depressed and dysfunctional, and we give them methylation support, and it's like, you know, their world changes, and they they over a few weeks they get, you know, 80-90% better in just a couple of weeks or a few weeks. That's a real rewarding experience. But there are other patients who have tried in the past, you know, typically before they find me, to take methylation support, and they get really bad symptoms from it. And it's confusing.
That's true.
Confusing because they have the genetic tendency. It seems based on their genetic test that they would need this supplement. And so that was really frustrating to me. And so from the problem-solving engineering point of view, it's like, okay, what's really going on here? And then we started to realize the patients who have the most negative reaction to methylation support, Dr. Kolb, have a gut problem. And once we realized that, you know, methylation vitamins, methylfolate, methyl B12, even choline, trimethylglycine, betaine, are basically mitochondrial fertilizer to some degree. And that's kind of what B vitamins are, right?
Right.
So if we eat a bunch of mitochondrial fertilizer and our gut is, as you mentioned earlier, we have a candida problem or a major bacterial overgrowth, those bugs will eat our... yes, they will eat that first. And what we what we get sick from are the toxins that those bugs poop out and leak into our system as a result of the fertilizer. So... look to the gut first if you're having a reaction.
Yeah, and we don't understand a lot about mycotoxins. I attended a meeting this week that Real Time Labs put on mycotoxins. And I know there's bacterial toxins as well that we've never even heard of or even considered that the dysbiosis patients have. Because, you know, the gut, when it's not balanced, God knows what it overgrows. I mean, it probably overgrows everything you can think of. And you're right. The not everybody with MTHFR does muscle tests for taking methyl donors. And that's something that healing the gut early on in the treatment protocol is very important.
I think it's so important. You know, if we understand. And I think that we do, that food is medicine. Well, then we have to make sure that when they eat that kale salad and have grass-fed beef and, you know, Jerusalem artichokes and all kinds of, you know, healthy food, that it can actually be absorbed by their body. Otherwise, it just feeds some other infection. And how much time do we have? Are we getting to the end pretty quick?
We have about 5 minutes.
Well, Dr.
Would you like to give your contact information?
Absolutely. To those in the audience who would like to learn more information about methylation, about the work I'm doing for my patients in Idaho here, and I also should point out we work over the phone and via Skype literally with people all over the world. I have a YouTube channel that's very well watched. But I would go to beyondmthfr.com, all just spelled out, beyondmthfr.com, and there you'll find all of my articles, blogs, research. And there's a contact form there if you'd like, you know, to reach out to my office. And we'd love to hear from you if you have any questions. Yeah.
And you've got a book coming out. I'm going to announce that so that you'll get on it. Because it is, you know, I spent several years writing my book, too. Eventually you just have to focus on it and get it out. Because it's going to be an important part of functional medicine once it comes out.
Well, I think that, you know, God put us on this planet for a purpose, and lucky are we who know what that is, you know?
Right.
I mean, and, you know, this is my life. I've dedicated myself to it. I spend, you know, when I sit home on the couch and I don't watch TV, my wife will sit there and kind of, you know, decompress, and I'm just on PubMed making slides, looking at research, answering questions. And
right.
So, to me, that's really, that's my medicine. It calms me down to make sense of the world that way. But yeah, definitely. The book, man, the book is going to be really good, and I know it's going to help people understand how to get started on this road of, you know, improving their health. And it's really looking at how the gut interacts with our genetic makeup. And, you know, just to leave the callers with the audience with a couple ideas here, you know, we have around 10 trillion cells, something like that. I think the latest data I found was that they think we have about 3.8 trillion adult cells in our body by the time we're, you know, full grown.
Mm-hmm.
There is 10 times as many cells, at least, in your gut than in your body.
Right.
But that's not even the most impressive part. The most impressive part is there's 100 times more DNA and genetic material in your gut than in your body. So whose DNA influences whose? They're 100. We're outnumbered 100 to 1.
We live in symbiosis with this system, and
truly,
if the system gets out of whack, it can really cause major, major health problems.
You know, it may not have started as a gut problem. I want to point this out. It may not have. It may have been a surgery that was botched or a bad product installed for a breast implant, or, you know, someone was remodeling your building where you worked for 6 months and they just used the worst off-gassing toxins and, you know, ripped up a bunch of moldy stuff. That may have been how the problem started. But once your body goes through that crash and it goes through that stress reaction and it's literally fighting to survive, when you're, like, stabilized and you're not falling down anymore, you're now left with a gut problem.
Right.
Even though
that's
it didn't start as one. Because if a patient's too fatigued to walk around the block, to do the dishes, to go for a small jog, if you don't feel as a patient or an individual like you have a lot of energy, there's not going to be a day when your stomach is going to feel like running a marathon if you're not. You know what I mean? So
Anybody who has like a crash an hour to an hour and a half after they eat, you've got a gut problem.
I would say so. I'd say you've eaten something you're allergic to, or you've eaten way too many carbohydrates, and now you're going and, you know, you're turning that glucose into fat, and it's just
Or you've got leaky gut, and you've got circulating immune complexes that are making you feel really bad. Joint aches, fatigue, whatever. And the way to diagnose that, if you're able to, not everybody is able to, but if you go on a fast, by about day two, you feel wonderful, you know, because your circulating immune complexes are gone. And, of course, you can't live that way. You can't fast forever. But that's how you diagnose that leaky gut.
That's a great idea. If you feel better when you don't eat, you have a gut problem.
You have a leaky gut problem, right? Too. And basically the explanation of that is that large complexes get through the gut that normally would not get through the gut, and then they get into your bloodstream, and your immune system starts attacking them because that's what it does. And then the joint aches are very common because these large proteins with these antibodies on them settle in the joints, probably the blood supply of the joints gets screwed up with those. I mean, I think it probably is just a clogging problem. And then inflammation comes along because of all of the cytokines that get released when that process occurs, because immune complexes cause a cytokine cascade. Silicone causes a cytokine cascade, too. They get massive inflammation, especially in their chest wall. So anytime you've got this inflammation without infection picture, you're probably talking about a cytokine problem.
Way more common than that's a common problem, and people, that's good advice to, get that fixed, because inflammation it's like, your body's own arsenal, and if your body's spending all its time blowing bridges up and rebuilding them over and over again, I mean, that's not a recipe for
failure. It's not doing other things it needs to be doing, yeah. And also, I mean, the end stage of that is autoimmune disease. I mean, that's how autoimmune disease occurs. If it's not an intracellular infection, I mean, that massive inflammation, and then cancer's tied to that too, that inflammation pathway. So
all roads seem to point towards inflammation as being the thing we have to manage and take responsibility for.
Right. Well, we are coming up to the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information one more time?
Absolutely. For interested parties, I would encourage you to check out my website at beyondmthfr.com. It's all brand new, it looks great, and it's easy to read, and all my thoughts and research articles are down there. And if you have questions or would like information about how we can connect and how I can be of service on your health journey, please just use the contact form on that website.
Well, great. Thanks so much for joining us, Andrew, and I wish you luck on your book. And I mean, think of it this way. God got you to this interview so that you could realize that silicone chemicals are a big part of problems with MTHFR. So, spiritually you're being helped along the way just with this interview. So that's good.
I know you're 100% right. And that's the truth of this whole process. I'm with you. I love that idea. And I'm gonna work hard, get that book done, and we'll talk next year about it. How's that?
Okay, yeah, we'll have you back on. Well, this is Dr. Susan Kolb. We've been interviewing Dr. Andrew Rostenberg on Beyond MTHFR, a very, very important component of toxicity in our everyday lives. Next week, we're going to be interviewing Megan Karnikas, A Deeper Perspective on Alzheimer's and Other Dementias, which we'll also be giving you very interesting information on that I've come across. Then Robert Henderson is on the 14th, Emotion and Healing in the Energy Body. Anyway, this is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.